Meditation.
Depending on the quality of my mind.
You know, there's good days and bad days. And good days as well.
Feel like the waterfall of thoughts. And every now and then, a nice calm.
I can't think of anything.
This is Meditation in the City.
The Shambhala, New York podcast.
John Sinhauser is a senior teacher in the Shambhala Buddhist tradition. And you're about to hear a talk he gave at our weekly Dharma gathering just last week. This was a talk about Shambhala. What is Shambhala? What is the Shambhala lineage? Where does it come from? Some information about the founder of the Shambhala Buddhist lineage, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, how it developed, how it came to America, and what it's all about. So perhaps if you've been listening for a while, you've been curious about what distinguishes the Shambhala Buddhist lineage from other Buddhist lineages or other types of meditation traditions, this is a good overview. This is a good orientation, so to speak, of what Shambhala is all about. Visit our website, ny.shambhala.org, for all of our upcoming courses and weekend retreats. I want you to know about Shambhala Training Weekend 1. It's happening the weekend of September 15th. It's an introductory weekend meditation intensive, and it's also a great introduction to the Shambhala teachings, the Shambhala philosophy, if you will. A good companion, if I may say, to this talk by John Sinhauser. So visit ny.shambhala.org, click the link on the homepage under Shambhala Training Weekend 1 to register or to find out some more information about it. Okay, here's John.
I thought I would just give a short talk on a little bit on the history, so to speak, of Shambhala and who we are. Like, what is Shambhala? Who is Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who founded Shambhala? Just to give you a little context for ourselves and for this tradition, which is different than other Buddhist traditions, definitely related. So if I could just go back to the beginning, not just to Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, but let's start at the beginning with the Buddha. And some of you probably know this already, but the Buddha was a prince in India 2,500 years ago and was raised to be the king of his territory and wasn't really allowed outside of the court grounds and had a very protected life. But he became curious as to what was going on out there, and he managed to slip out a few times and was stunned what he found and was disturbed by it. And this really propelled him to want to look into the questions of what he saw as the pains of birth, old age, sickness, and death. It didn't make any sense to him based on his previous life in the court, which was very little suffering. So he saw tremendous suffering out there, and he decided to give up this kingship that he was destined for, being Prince Siddhartha, and left and began to explore these questions for himself. And he went to various teachers, yoga, ascetics, and nothing really answered his questions for him. So he decided simply to sit down and meditate under the Bodhi tree. And he sat and he meditated. And he finally became what they called enlightened. And that's a whole other topic of what enlightenment is. But we could say in this situation, he began to have some insights into pain and suffering, and joy as well, and compassion, and human qualities that we all possess and that he began to experience through the practice of meditation. And he began teaching, and originally he really taught more in a monastic tradition. His students were monks, and that's the way it continued for a long time after his death. But as Buddhism spread throughout India, It developed into not just a monastic tradition, but we call householders like ourselves, people that had regular jobs, that had families. So it wasn't just the people in monasteries or the infamous people in caves, but it included all parts of the population at that time. And then great universities began to develop, so it wasn't just the practice of meditation, but also study, which flourished in India. And then some of the great teachers in India were not just monastic. Some were, but some were not. For example, the great King Ashoka, maybe you've heard of him in India, who actually was a terrifying leader who had armies, terrible massacres of people. And it is said that one day he went out and looked at what he'd done and had great remorse and basically decided to change his life and began practice meditation and study and changed the whole feeling of India, started hospitals and schools and veterinary clinics, and changed the culture of India. So it also spread into China, Japan, Southeast Asia. And as it spread, it took on the cultures of those countries. So it wasn't just one kind of Buddhism. It incorporated the richness and the knowledge of those cultures. So it was, you could say, living. It was a living tradition, a living religion. So it went into Tibet in two phases, around 700, and then later around 1100. And there were some great teachers that took it into India, into Tibet from India. And they began teaching in Tibet. And as the years went on, there developed to be different schools of Tibetan Buddhism. And Tibetan Buddhism was came to Tibet at a time when Tibet did have indigenous religions, so to speak, something called the Bun tradition, which much more related to the energies of nature, of the elements, of energies of the phenomenal world. And so as Buddhism grew in Tibet, it took some of this teaching, some of these practices on as well. And that's sort of what became known as Tibetan Buddhism. Mostly it was monastic for a large time, but there were traditions within that of, first of all, some of the schools of Tibetan Buddhism were monastic, and some of them, even though there were monasteries, their teachers and their leaders were married, they were householders. And then there was also tradition of much smaller of Buddhism being there amongst people like ourselves, of lay people that were not connected to monasteries particularly. So one of the lineages there, which was the way teachings were passed down from generation to generation, was the lineage at Sermang, which was part of the Kagyu lineage. And Sermang was a particular place. And that is where Trungpa Rinpoche was educated and born in that area. And there was a lineage of Trungpas, of incarnate lamas. And he was the 11th Trungpa, and he was schooled in a very traditional way. There was a head teacher, a tutor. It was monastic, it was strict. There was not a lot of leeway, very highly disciplined. And he did very well, and was also his main teacher was in a different monastery, so he was given different, slightly different teachings apart from Sir Mong. So there was a sense of something other than just his particular monastery. And he told stories later that when he was there, he also began having these dreams about Shambhala, which is the, you could say, a legend of Shambhala. And it goes back to when the Buddha was alive. And the story goes that the first king of Shambhala, Dawasangpo, asked the Buddha for teachings, not so much about attaining some sort of religious enlightenment and going on to the next life, but how could he govern his kingdom in a sane and human and decent way? So it was a secular situation. He asked the Buddha for teachings about everyday life and how he could help his people, not just spiritually, but in this, what you could say, a more secular way. So that was the beginnings of the original Shambhala teachings that go way back to that time. And Trungpa Rinpoche began having dreams about that. And he didn't really know what that meant at that time, but he said that he had very strong connections to that, which you have to understand was very different than living in a monastery in Eastern Tibet. And Eastern Tibet was sort of like our Wild West. It was just sort of the opposite. It was rugged, it was mountainous, there were no real cities, let alone big towns like Lhasa and other places in Tibet. And so he didn't really know what to make of these dreams of Shambhala, which was a much more about a society, a much bigger society altogether. So when the Chinese came in 1959, and he realized that he could not stay there, that it was time to leave. And of course, there were thousands of people that left, including the Dalai Lama and other great leaders that felt that they had to make a choice between leaving their people behind or saving themselves, but more than that, saving the Dharma, saving the teachings, the Buddhist teachings, that if they stayed, it could all perish. So they fled, and he went to India, like many other Tibetans. And there's a wonderful book, if you're interested in more of this, called Born in Tibet, that Trungpa Rinpoche wrote about his early life and his journey outside of his journey into India, which was quite grueling. And some of it's quite amusing terms in terms of how they would trick the Chinese communists and get away and take this river instead of that river. It's a wonderful book. It's not a heavy, serious book. It's quite personal and delightful in a way. So he goes to India, and he goes to a place where they were taking Tibetan lamas, which was ironically run by an English woman. And it was a place for him to be. But he realized, again, that this was not, somehow was not his fate to stay here in this sort of monastic situation. And through this woman that ran it, she felt that it would really be helpful if he went to England. And he received a scholarship to Oxford University. And so he went to England to study. And he became proficient in English, and he was fascinated by the Western world. He was fascinated by people like ourselves, the Western mind. Who were we? And it's totally outside the context of ever he'd ever experienced anything before in Tibet. So he studied philosophy, he studied Western psychology, he studied Western religions. He studied everything he could to become more familiar with Westerners and the Western way of life. And he's also written about that, which is very interesting and amusing as well. He became fluent in English, and he finished at Oxford, and then he started a very small abbey up in Scotland. And he went there to teach, and he wanted to spread the Dharma teachings as he knew it. So it was very small. It was in a rural area. And after some years, it simply wasn't working. People weren't coming. He was teaching very traditional Tibetan tantric Buddhism, which involved visualizations, it involved mantra, it involved all these sort of esoteric practices, prostrations, and it just didn't click. It didn't click with people over there. There were a few close students, but by and large, people, it just didn't work. And he realized that this was not working. And so he felt at that time that he needed to take off his robes and not be a monastic anymore, and to really immerse himself in Western culture, become a lay person. He got married to an English woman, and shortly thereafter, they were invited to come to the United States by a group of students. And so he went to Vermont, to Barnet, Vermont, and a group of students there hosted him. And there was a farmhouse there, and that became his new home. And he had several children, and then he was asked to go out to Boulder, Colorado, and teach out there. And there was a group of hippie students called the Pygmies that had land up in the mountains near Fort Collins. And they said, we want you to teach here, and this could be your center. And there was a big shift that happened at that point. So he began realizing that he had to present these teachings to laymen, lay people like ourselves, that were not interested in being monastic, that were not interested in living in caves, but that are interested in living a life of work in cities, being in relationships, being part of the world. And how could he present the teachings in that way? And when he came to the United States, he became very friendly with a wonderful Zen teacher, Suzuki Roshi. And for those of you that have done Zazen, it's very similar to shamatha. It's basically sitting and just meditating quietly using the same technique. And it's not about visualizing and any of these esoteric practices. And he realized that that was the way he could begin working with Western students, a way to work with our busy, busy, busy minds. And that doing all sorts of visualizations and other fancy practices would only make things worse. We would become busier, we would even get more conceptual that we were. And so sitting practice became the way he introduced Buddhism to Western students. He taught as well in a tradition that was traditional. So in Tibetan Buddhism, you have practice and you have study, and they're equally important. And he continued that tradition through talks, through writing books, through starting centers. New York Center is one of the oldest, back to 1971. And urban centers began popping up, and he began traveling and teaching. So when he came here and started teaching, he was not conventional in the sense of other Tibetan teachers, and there weren't many of them back in 1970. There were Zen teachers, and there were a few Tibetan teachers, and there were a few teachers in the Theravadan tradition. But many of them were monastic, and they wore robes. And so he wasn't that conventional in that sense. In fact, some of the early pictures, you'd think that he was a hippie up in Vermont. And since I was one of those young hippies, I could relate to that. He was very accessible. It wasn't, you know, a lama sitting up with his robes on doing fancy things. He hung out, so to speak. Now that changed over the years, but that's the way he began to relate to Western students. And this practice of shamatha vipassana was essential in his teachings. It was much more important than studying, because he saw that we had busy, busy minds and that we were very conceptual. Everything had to be reduced to some concept. And as you know, or you will probably begin to see as you sit, you have to just cut through the concepts and be here. Experience your breath, experience your mind, experience your heart, hopefully with a sense of humor, with a sense of gentleness to yourself, so we're not going to get into our habitual patterns of judging ourselves, but a light touch. And that was an important part of how he presented this, not as a solemn new religion in which another way yet to judge ourselves. Are we a good meditator? How long can we follow our breath? Throw that sort of self-improvement project out the window and just be here and sit with ourselves and make friends with ourselves. And as we do that, we begin to open up our hearts, and that in turn helps us to open our hearts to others, because this path in the end is really about helping others. First starting with ourselves, to see what our own confusion is. So if we don't see what our own confusion is, we're probably not going to be able to help others. So we start by trying to relax with ourselves, and then we go out and trying to help others with their confusion. And then hopefully, especially in this day and age, with society's confusion altogether. So it was fairly traditional. The teachings themselves were fairly traditional in terms of what even the Buddha taught about the Four Noble Truths, the causes of suffering, for example. But then in the late 1970s, he began to return to what he had those dreams about, was the legend of the kingdom of Shambhala, about how to be in a society that was not all Buddhist, it was not a theocracy like Tibet, and how to actually bring the aspirations of Shambhala, of how to lead a good and decent life, and to have some joy in that. So those of you that have studied some of Shambhala, it's interesting that even though we get around to eventually studying suffering and the cause of suffering, we start off with the good news, which is that human nature is basic goodness, that we're basically decent, kind beings with wisdom. We just have to uncover it. And it's that premise that Shambhala is based on, how to create a good society of decent human beings, and how to uncover that through the practice of meditation. So in 17 short years, that Trungpa Rinpoche presented an enormous amount of teachings. There are many books and recordings and centers. And when he died, after he died, his son, the Sakyong Mipham Rinpoche, took over as our main teacher and has been leading us since then. And he himself is not a monastic. He's married with a family and three beautiful young daughters, one of whom will become the leader after the Sakyong passes on. So that will be having a woman as our teacher, as our main teacher. So I think the important thing here to remember is that Shambhala, as started by Trungpa Rinpoche and is now led by the Sakyong, is really about practicing on the cushion, shamatha practice, making friends with ourselves, beginning to have some stability in our mind, and discovering our heart and opening up to that, being vulnerable, and then taking that out into the world in a compassionate way, and not in a crusading way, but in a gentle way. And that, in essence, you could say, is what Shambhala is about, both the practice on the cushion, but the practice off the cushion of engaged Buddhism with the world. So I'm going to stop at this point. There's a lot more to say, but if you have questions about the actual practice, which I gave earlier, or about anything I've said, please, we have some time for questions and answers.
I've asked this question before, and I so much believe in the compassion of Buddhism and the way it's taught, etc. But how do you deal with people that are just totally hopeless, the murderers and people like that? What do they say to do with them? How do you just don't stay away from them, or you help them, or what can you do for people that are so beyond the pale, shall we say?
Well, I think we always have to start at a personal level. And I think, so for example, it's important, I think, the way to work with that at a rather simple level. And I always give the example for myself of, you know, a cab driver is irritating the shit out of me because they're either going a different way and the meter's going to go up, or they're talking about something I don't want to hear. And they're being, I would say, obnoxious or aggressive, right? And it's just trying to relax with that and understand maybe where they're coming from, that they're experiencing pain themselves, that they're experiencing confusion, and trying to help them even simply by listening and having some compassion for their state of mind, and not jumping down their throat and not getting mad and not fueling the fires of more anger and aggression. And yes, sometimes we have to actually say something, but it doesn't have to be barking at them. It could be a gentle way of helping them wake up to something. Mm-hmm. Now, as far as, you know, the rest of it, societal, that's a much longer or much bigger problem that I don't think we have time to go into tonight. But it's starting with ourselves, where we're coming from. And if we can get triggered in an angry way by something like that, that's where we have to begin. Okay?
What is the relationship between the Dalai Lama, who is famous, and this teacher? Is there a branch or something like that?
Well, so as the Buddhism developed in Tibet over the years, there were teachers, and they began to have their own lineages, and the differences philosophically are subtle, and so that there were four main schools of Buddhism that developed, and the Dalai Lama is, other than his political position, he was in the Gelugpa school, and Trungpa Rinpoche was in combined Nyingma and Kagyu, and so they both you could say, philosophically, for lack of better words, are on the same page for most of it. But the differences between them are more subtle philosophically. Yeah.
In the few times I've been here, that there was talk that there's three, sitting position, a walking, and a third one. And I do a lot of walking, and I was wondering if you could just talk about, is it the same just thought of the breath when I'm walking and sitting, or is there something more?
You mean in the shrine room?
In the other room?
No, I mean when you're sitting here at the center, when you're walking here in the
No, when I'm...
When you're walking on the street?
Yes.
Okay. I just should mention there is something that you will get some instruction about during these periods of sitting. There's something called walking meditation, which you would get specific instruction on. Thank you for asking that. So in terms of, it's often called and sort of maybe erroneously post-meditation practice, so when we're not here sitting or walking in the center. What we're really trying to do here is develop mindfulness. And so it's the reason it's called practice is we're practicing on the cushion. So when we're in the world, we can take this out into the world with us. So the idea is to develop mindfulness and awareness. And so when we're outside on the street, rather than text or talk on the cell phone or space out, it's just to pay attention to what's happening. So notice the traffic light, notice other people, notice the colors, notice the signs. Be present with whatever is happening. Be present. And in a way, that begins to open up our hearts rather than pulling in into our little world. Be on the subway, notice things. When you're at home, the proverbial chopping the carrots, how does that feel? Rather than thinking about what you're going to do later. So it's sort of being present with whatever you're doing. And that in turn opens up our mind and heart rather than being caught up in the constant sort of AM radio dialogue we have with ourselves. Is that what you're asking about? Yeah. Thanks for asking that.
So I've been practicing for a short amount of time, but a little bit over a year. And what I've noticed is when you talk about the opening of the heart and walking down the street and just going about your normal daily life, and I'm finding that I'm having these experiences where I'm sinking into the moment in a way that I haven't before, meaning I might see a flower and I'm just transfixed by it in a way that I might have walked right past that flower 1,000 times. Can you talk a little bit about that, about how it feels when your heart opens and those experiences where you find yourself on a train platform and tearing up because the rain feels good, you know?
That's great. Stay with it. Just stay with it. Don't push it out. And then it opens up into something, but just it's a beautiful experience. And so just stay there. And particularly, you know, I think from my experience, when it happens on the cushion and we some memories come up that are painful, don't push them away. Just let it be there. It's safe on the cushion. And just open up to that. Yeah. Thank you.
I was wondering if you could say something about the student-teacher relationship a little bit, since you've experienced that. As you probably know, there have been some scandals recently, and I know a lot of people are sort of questioning, you know, what does that mean? And I know that we sort of have a weird idea of what that is here in the West, of what a teacher-student relationship is, what, you know, what it's like to have, you know, be in love with the guru and devotion and all that. I get the impression it's a lot more ordinary than we think it is. But I'm struggling with that personally. And so I'm just wondering what your take is on it.
Well, the student-teacher relationship, you could say, has different stages. And so in the beginning, it's really just relating to a teacher as an elder, he or she is teaching you something. It's a fairly traditional student-teacher relationship, which may or may not have any kind of personal connection. And then sometimes you may find that something else develops out of that, some connection, some trust. And trust is an important part which begins to develop. And you could say, in turn, that sort of becomes what you call a spiritual friend. And what happens, just like with any friend, there's more sharing that can go on. And like a good friend sometimes may call you on something. So it's more open and it's more vulnerable. It's not so arm's length. And then eventually that can mature into what in this traditional or Tibetan Buddhism is called a guru relationship, where over time, because of your experience with this person, you develop real trust in that person to really help guide you on the path. And then it becomes more personal as well, in terms of, it's for those of you that know Pema Chodron, somebody asked her this, how did she know that Trungpa Rinpoche was her teacher? And she's told this little story about a situation, and she said, he really nailed me on my trip. And she said, then I knew he was my teacher. So there's love with that, because they care enough about you to do that. And then the other thing is, you know, they give you certain practices which help you to do it for yourself. So the point of a student, of a guru, is not to have this person that you're totally dependent on for the rest of your life, but you eventually develop your own, what they call inner guru, so you can see for yourself and you don't feel dependent on somebody else.
Hello, how you doing? I've been kind of thinking about just the power of our emotions. Just before you came in, a memory came in my mind, and it was like a feelings of shame from a past experience. And I just wondering, like, could the past emotions, whether it's through meditation or mindfulness, could you, is it possible we could actually elicit a lesson from that particular emotion each time when we're in a specific practice such as this? That's my question.
Yeah, that's a great question. Yes, absolutely. And that's interesting, because I've talked more a little bit about shamatha, or mindfulness practice, which is stabilizing our mind. But the other part of it is vipassana practice, which is the development of insight. And so when we're able to stabilize our mind a little bit more without all the chatter, inner chatter, something goes deeper, and that's when we can develop insight, and you call it lessons, which is the same thing. So by letting all this stuff arise, emotions and whatever, something begins to gel, and we cut through our conceptual mind, and something deeper comes out, which it's a lesson. And I think the example you gave, you know, we all go through situations of feeling shame or remorse for something. And the Sakyong has talked about sort of the difference between feeling remorse and feeling just guilty. And he said, you know, guilty is just beating ourselves up. I was a bad person, I'm terrible, blah, blah, blah. And this culture, as we know, sort of engenders that. You did this wrong, you did that wrong, you should do this, blah, blah, blah. And real remorse is, he said, it's two things. It's feeling some sense of sadness about what you've done, but it's also that you have some insight into it. And that's true remorse, and that will actually lead us to not doing that again. So there's a lesson. So it's not just feeling guilty and bad and feeling like shit, but it's actually benefiting our own development and certainly benefiting others, so we don't repeat those patterns. Thank you. Great question. Yeah.
That question just brought to mind forgiveness.
Absolutely, forgiveness, yes. Yeah, I think that's certainly part of it, absolutely. And that has to do with a big part of this path is just not beating ourselves up, you know, and making friends with ourselves, warts and all.
And yeah. doing metta, the metta practice.
Yes, and the metta practice, here it's called Maitri practice. It's mm-hmm. the same derivation, but it's basically making friends with yourself, loving kindness practice.
Can you go through that a bit for us?
I can't tonight, actually, but that's a good topic. Whoever is arranging talks, we need to sort of wind up. But that would take a long time. It's wonderful, though. I hope maybe some other night somebody could talk about that Maitri practice, because it's essential. Yeah, thank you.
So is there a time when you might start a teacher might give you a visualization? Is there a progression that would lead to visualizations or mantras?
Okay, so basically the short answer to that is in Shambhala, we go through stages, and it's a traditional part of Vajrayana or Tibetan Buddhism, Vajrayana Buddhism from India, actually. We begin with the Hinayana, which is basically working on ourselves and seeing our own confusion. And that's basic sitting practice and studying things like the Four Noble Truths, the causes of suffering and the liberation from suffering. But it's trying to liberate ourselves, and it's mostly through sitting practice. And then when we begin to have some open heart to ourselves and loving kindness to ourselves, it naturally leads to compassion for others, which moves into what's called Mahayana practice, and it's really helping others. And we might take a vow, a bodhisattva vow, that we vow to save all sentient beings before we become fully enlightened. It's an amazing vow that others are important. And it's not just being a doormat. So it's practices that can open our heart more. And then the third part, which is called Vajrayana, is basically a part of the Mahayana of helping others and helping to create enlightened society. And that's when these other practices are introduced, which simply are other tools, skillful means to move us along more quickly. And that's when the teacher gives us visualization and mantra and other practices that are more often connected with Tibetan Buddhism.
But they're still within the Shambhala tradition.
Yes, absolutely.
So that would be the level 1, 2, 3 that is taught here.
Yeah, levels. Well, the levels basically deal with the first two parts of it, Hinayana, Mahayana. And then there's more programs and retreats that you do. And then it eventually leads towards Vajrayana, which comes later with those practices.
Thank you.
But it's definitely included in this path. Yes, thanks.
All right, thank you. You've just cleared up a lot. Thank you. Good.
Yes, right in front.
Yeah, is there cultivation of jhanas in this practice?
Cultivation of jhanas, of dhyanas, other states in the meditation practice?
Not particularly. I'm not
like
sure.
Like in Theravada, there's Vipassana meditation, and then there's cultivation of other sort of ecstatic states, but they're just passageways called jhanas.
That's not particularly part of this tradition. Okay. Yeah.
How is Shambhala different than Zen?
Okay, so. Zen tradition is what in the three stages I just told you about. It's a very core of the Mahayana teachings, which is where we move out to the working with the world. What it doesn't have, I'm not saying that in a negative way, but Vajrayana simply has more tools and devices to speed that along. So all the practices of Tibetan Buddhism, visualization, mantras, all these kind of things, you don't find so much in Zen, but the goals are exactly the same. It's to liberate ourselves and help others to liberate themselves. Yeah. And I should add that I mentioned that Trungpa Rinpoche was so taken with Suzuki Roshi, who was a prominent Zen teacher then, and really made sitting practice our core practice. So he has had a lot of respect for Zen Buddhism, and in fact, a lot of our aesthetics are connected to Zen Buddhism, and all some of our other teachings here, calligraphy, flower arranging, kudos, tea ceremony, are all out of the Japanese and Zen traditions. Yeah. Having, not having a cluttered shrine, not having tankas all over the place, which are very Tibetan, the sort of cleaner look is very much related to the Zen tradition. Yeah. Okay. So thank you, everybody. I hope this last minute talk was informative and enjoyable for you. Thank you. Thank you.
Not only informative, but enjoyable. John Sinhauser, thank you very much for that talk. Email us at podcast@shambhalanyc. Your questions, comments, suggestions. Visit our website, ny.shambhala.org, for all of our fall programs. We've got weekend programs. We've got weeknight classes. We have daytime classes. Everything you need to learn about meditation and Shambhala Buddhist teachings. If you happen to live in a different city, there's probably a Shambhala Meditation Center near you. Look us up. But if you are in the New York City area, come visit our weekly Dharma gathering. It's every Tuesday night at 7 o'clock. You can hear these talks live and in person. You can meet the other meditators. It's a good community. It's a nice vibe. Come. Really, you're invited. Later.